You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Never Built Los Angeles is a project where the what if of LA is explored through over 100 years of architectural drafts, models, and drawings contained within the Getty Research Institute's archive. Curators and co-authors Greg Golden and Sam Lubell investigate the values and untapped potential of a city that, to this day, is trying to solve the riddle of what it wants to become. This unrealized architectural vision for Los Angeles comes together in a stunning book and exhibition, inviting viewers to ponder a fantasy land Los Angeles of projects never built, recognizing that many of the unrealized works were, in fact, disasters averted. Be it a city divided by competing visions and unrealized projects, this project has brought together a myriad of institutions and initiated grand collaborations, as well as providing us an opportunity to discuss our future by looking at our past. To discuss the unbuilt history of our city, our panelists, Greg Golden, co-curator of Never Built Los Angeles and co-author of the book of the same name. Greg has written widely about architecture and urban affairs for Los Angeles Magazine, LA Weekly, the LA Times, and Architects Newspaper. Sitting next to Greg is Mia Lehrer, founder of the design and development firm Mia Lehrer & Associates, known for its ambitious public and private projects. Mia is internationally recognized for her progressive landscape designs, coupled with her advocacy for ecology and people-friendly public space. Next to Mia is Sam Lubell, co-curator of Never Built Los Angeles and co-author of the book, as well as West Coast editor of the Architects newspaper. Sam has written 5 books about architecture, including Julia Shulman, Los Angeles, The Birth of a Modern Metropolis. Next to Sam is Christopher Hawthorne, architecture critic for the Los Angeles Times. Before coming to the Times, Chris was architecture critic for Slate and a frequent contributor to the New York Times. He is the author, with Elena Stang, of The Greenhouse, New Directions in Sustainable Architecture. And our moderator this evening, Alan Hess, architect, historian, and author, whose 19 books on modern architecture and urbanism include monographs on Oscar Niemeyer, Frank Lloyd Wright, and John Lautner, as well as the architectural histories that span from Las Vegas to Googie architecture. As a preservationist, Alan qualified the oldest remaining McDonald's drive-in restaurant located in Downey for the National Register of Historic Places. Please join me in welcoming our guests to Aloud at the LA Public Library.
That's a cheer. Well, okay.
You're on.
Great to see all of you here. And if any of you were at the opening of Never Built the other night, it gave me hope that there is a growing public interest in architecture and design. And very possibly Pacific Standard Time that the Getty has been putting on has a lot to do with that, but we need to keep the ball rolling. And this is a really great exhibit, well-researched, vast, in-depth, a lot of original material that has not been seen for decades, if not a century or more, and that's what we need here in Los Angeles. We need to know more about our past so that we can move into the future. It is, in many ways, I thought as I went through it, like Alice through the Looking Glass. when Alice stepped through the looking glass, everything looked the same, except everything did not look the same. And this gives us a sense of what Los Angeles is. That's very familiar, but also what doesn't look quite familiar, and why isn't it familiar? And we're going to explore a lot of those questions tonight. It covers a lot of things that Los Angeles is all about, technology and architecture, suburbia, the automobile, the airplane, landscape architecture and green space, open space, commercial architecture, residences, public spaces, both the neighborhood and the civic scale. It includes everything from a high-rise by Jean Nouvel to Bible Storyland, neither of which were done, and we can talk about whether or not that was either good or bad. But we're going to start out with, just to give you a taste of what the exhibit is about, Sam is going to show us a couple of slides that give you an idea of this range. So, want to go ahead?
Sure. And I should mention that while the idea did grow out of a conversation and a collaboration with the Getty Research Institute, that we dug through how many archives, Greg?
Lost count at probably 20 or 30.
A lot of archives. So it was just so much fun. We went through,
including the Los Angeles Public Library,
including the and USC and UCSB and UCLA and the Huntington and the City Archives and the Metro Archives.
And there's a lot more to be found, right?
There is, sure. Yeah.
Yes, and if anybody has any, please don't tell us.
So we're going to show you a couple, actually more than a couple, but we'll try to be quick, just to give you a taste, and I'm sure that you'll get a taste along the way as we talk. But the first one here is Frank Lloyd Wright's Doheny Ranch, which was basically a housing development in the hills above Beverly Hills for the oil man, Edward Doheny, who I'm sure many of you have heard of. And the idea was to, instead of knocking over hillsides and putting boxes on top of them, weave intricate textile block houses and bridges and retaining walls, and sort of make this a completely new type of development. I think it would have changed the way development happened in L.A.
Brought down by Teapot Dome, like Doheny himself, sadly.
Greg, you want to talk about the Civic Center?
Oh, well, you can look at this is the first Grand Avenue scheme. And right in the middle, if you look very closely, is the building we're in, or next to the building we're in, is the public library. Sam's tall enough to point it out. Right there.
We're in the middle.
So you're looking up Grand Avenue at the Mesoamerican fascistic architecture.
Well,
I think
of
that's
Lloyd Wright.
There's a lot more to it, but I think that's
right.
Well,
not to be confused with his father.
And this is a plan, the original plan. You may recognize it from the cover of the book, but this is the original plan for LAX that the master planners of the current LAX came up with originally. And this is one giant terminal for LAX instead of the way it is now, covered by a glass dome. And they couldn't convince the building department to sign off. They thought it was too radical.
Rejected by the city of Los Angeles.
Yes. And also the airlines didn't want to share the space, and they also couldn't quite figure out how to air condition it. That's what we were told. So a lot other reasons too, I'm sure. But and this was a nifty idea to get you from LAX to downtown. This is the Sky Lounge, and you see the helicopter, but if you look down below the helicopter, those are buses, and that's the helicopter, this Sikorsky helicopter, would pick up those buses and take you to downtown.
These things work, actually. They flew them.
They're ready to
They did test runs of this particular thing.
Yeah, there are prototypes that we've seen pictures of.
Yeah.
So. Well, the Sky Lounge. This is an interesting one. This is a proposal in the Santa Monica Bay, one of many by Dim Jim, a very powerful firm with Anthony Lumsden and Cesar Pelli. And this is a plan for a hotel, basically projecting out of the ocean.
It's made up of CDs before they were invented.
Yes, I'm sure that's what he said on the design document.
I'm sure of that.
And this was a plan not too long ago by Stephen Hull for the Natural History Museum, a project that Mia is now very familiar with. Not this project, but the museum. She did the new gardens, which are beautiful.
Yes, hooray for Mia.
You haven't been. The idea here was to put those gardens literally on the roof here. You can see this green wall. What you can't see, there's a green roof that steps down behind there to Exposition Park. Pretty interesting scheme, I think. And that was killed off. The board kind of lost its fundraising abilities, and there was a earthquake retrofit program that didn't pass. Is that right?
Yeah, a bond measure to retrofit the building for earthquake safety. It didn't pass. And so, you can see that Herzog and de Meuron looked at this very carefully before they built their de Young Museum
that tower,
in San Francisco.
You may recognize that tower. Would have been a great view of L.A., actually. So, this is an interesting one. The original plan for Disneyland was not in Anaheim. It was in Burbank, across the street from Disney's current studios, which is on the north side of this plan here, above Riverside, and just east of Buena Vista. And this is a rudimentary version of Disneyland that the town council in 1952 turned down because they thought it was going to bring a carny atmosphere.
That's it.
To Burbank.
And boy, were they right.
Yeah. God forbid. Yeah. Exactly. Carny?
Carny. Carny, as in carnival.
Yeah, carnival. Yeah.
Can't have that in Burbank.
Corny, yeah. And corny.
It was okay for Anaheim, or maybe Glendale.
So they didn't get it. This bit of a miscalculation, I think, from Burbank. But
it is next to the L.A. River.
Yes, there's the L.A. River, the L.A. Flood Control Channel, they call it, at the bottom there. So, and then, you want to talk about this one, Greg?
The most lamented, I think, of all the proposals for the city in 1930, the Olmsted and Bartholomew proposal.
The sons of Frederick Law Olmsted, designer of Central Park and many, many, many other parks.
Right, to ring the entire region in parks and then to infill it with neighborhood parks. It would have completely changed Los Angeles.
And interspersed, each park was connected via tree-lined and grass-lined parkways. So you would have been
It's right. Big regrets.
Yeah. So, and then another major game changer, in 1925, transit consultants Kelker Deleu proposed this plan for over 140 miles of subway and elevated rail.
152 miles of subways and elevated at a time when all you needed was a steam shovel.
Would have been a lot easier then, yeah.
Cut and cover.
Yeah. So, and this was actually went to a vote in the city and was turned down.
The Los Angeles Times was opposed to it.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Can you? Never opposed anything.
Yeah. I can't understand that at all.
And also, there were many, many of these. This one looks like a Cadillac, but there are many monorails proposed. We have this one was proposed in the 1960s. There were proposals also in the 50s. And this
50s, 40s, 30s,
yeah.
20s,
we have
10s,
30s.
And 1900, Fox Folly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
It's very popular. You can build it a lot quicker than a subway, and it moves you know, a lot faster, too.
They're actually not a bad idea.
Yeah, it does block the light. I think that's why some people, but they and among other reasons, they wanted the farebox revenues, but they would have built this for free. And essentially, a lot of these plans died, ironically, because the city wanted to build a subway at the time.
Right.
It took them about 30 years.
Which Beverly Hills opposed, so that stopped too.
Yeah.
And so it goes.
And this is one of the monorail maps. You can see how broad of a distance they were planning to cover from Long Beach up to way into the valley, way over towards the ocean. So that's pretty wide net they were going to cast. And then finally, the weirdest of all, possibly all, I think, unless if you can find a weirder one, let us know. This was the Santa Monica Causeway, stretching from downtown Santa Monica over the ocean to Malibu, over islands of development that sort of look like Dubai. But this was in early 1960s.
Yeah, I think it starts in 1959. But now, as Mia has pointed out, if you're a billionaire over there in the Malibu colony, you favor this plan. You might even finance it, given the rising waters of global warming.
You may not have had the same kind of experience on the beach looking at a freeway, though. So, so these are just a very small sampling, as you've seen the book and the show, but this gives you a taste of what we're going to talk about. And sort of the alternate universe that we have discovered in researching this show.
Well, Greg, you seem to have some laments that the Olmsted plan was not built. I wanted to ask each of you, which of these projects would have made the biggest difference, have set a pattern or set Los Angeles in a different direction, do you think, if it had gotten built?
Go for it, Mia.
Thank you for giving it to me. it would have been this plan, or at least the one I could probably speak to a little bit more. But the notion of doing a comprehensive plan that addressed the public realm through parks and open space, and really not only had the plan and the layout, but also thought of all the mechanisms in order to get it built, both the taxing mechanism, the legislation. It proposed a body that was sort of independent and yet obviously a governmental body that actually would push forward. It depended on some taxes, and eventually was killed because there was a tax proposal out there for Owens Valley Water. So basically, once again, water won over parks, or, you know, the way, and if we think about it, you know, how it changed our city. The fact that we started then depending, we could have parks, and maybe we had had less water, so we would have been in a completely different city. Because with less water, we would have learned how to live with less water. So it's kind of an interesting issue, sort of this whole notion of sort of this a little bit of a lack of foresight in some ways. But, you know, we've also all been educated about these issues. We never thought water would you know, was a finite resource until more recently, I guess. So I think that's the plan that I feel is the biggest loss, and there is that irony there. So,
did you want to talk about which one?
Which one I felt was the biggest? Yeah. I mean, I probably would have to second what Mia says about the Olmsted plan. Then I begin to scratch my head a little bit.
So there'd be a park within 10-minute walking distance for everybody. Not all parks would be the same size, obviously, and we have a lot of big parks in L.A. We are not underserved in that way. It's just they're not necessarily, given the megalopolis and given the extents and horizontality of the city, they're just not necessarily in the areas that got densely developed. And we didn't plan, as we were doing more development, for parks within those areas.
Well, part of the idea of suburbia, which was certainly developing throughout the century, was that everybody would have their own little bit of green space in their backyards. And that came true pretty much. Was there a controversy between that? I think, was that the tension, do you think, between public green space versus private green space?
Well,
I think it was probably too early for that tension to have emerged. It was the late 20s when, and it's also interesting to think about how that plan came to be. It was a Chamber of Commerce proposal, and it was some of the leaders of the Chamber of Commerce who ended up killing it when they got cold feet, when they realized just how radical and extensive and revolutionary it might be for the city. So I think it was more about the control over that land and turning so much of the city over into protected green space that began to give the members of the chamber themselves, the original patrons of the plan, cold feet about what it might lead to in the city.
But there, it's true what Christopher says. It precedes the invention of what we call suburbia. But there already was this tension in the city between a vertical city and a horizontal city. And while the Olmsted plan, I don't know that it was directly affected by that division, many of the other plans that you look at in the 1920s and 1930s break on those very lines. Were we going to build a city that would be along commercial lines with intense high-rise development, as we were witnessing in the East, or was it going to be this spread out city with which laid the groundwork for the suburban idea that emerged in the post-war? And we know which one kind of won.
And sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just the irony is that we sort of know which one won, but I think in a lot of ways, LA is still trying to figure that question out.
It is,
you know,
yeah.
It's, And if you don't know exactly what you want to be, it's hard to move forward sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But Mia's right to raise the point about how the astonishing kind of political savvy of that document, if anybody looks at the great Bill Devereaux, Greg Heist book that kind of rescued that plan, which I recommend, it's not just a really far-reaching, far-sighted plan in terms of design, but in terms of politics. And the Olmsted brothers, having worked in a number of cities and having really begun to understand how American cities worked politically, did propose an incredible range of ways to implement it, to pay for it, this plan. It was anything but a pie in the sky proposal, and that's what's really changed. You don't really see another plan that comes as fully cooked and as ready to implement that is so sophisticated and smart about politics. And in fact, the committee that the chamber put together to try to shepherd that plan through had probably close to 100 members. By when all was said and done, most of the best connected lawyers and architects and many of the politicians of the day who were calling the shot. So it was that's the one that actually surprises me in some ways, mm-hmm. given, I mean, it's not surprising that it didn't happen given its ambition. Mm-hmm. It is surprising given how carefully it seemed to lay the groundwork politically. Of course, the political wind shifted and then, you know, the Depression came and sort of put the final nail in the that coffin.
And one thing I should say is when you read that report and when you read some of these reports, they were very prescient. I mean, the Olmsted Bartholomew, they did predict in a lot of ways exactly what happened. There's, you know, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen, and that's what we're looking at, basically what we're looking at now. I don't think everybody had the vision that the city could possibly grow to the extent that it has grown. Mm-hmm. I don't think people quite understood that. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Kelker and DeLue, it's sort of the same. They were warning that this was going to become a city that would sprawl beyond whatever anybody imagined. And when you look at Charles Mulford Robinson, which is earlier, I guess, you know, the first decade of the 20th century, he was saying the same thing. Like, you know, we need to, this is looks like the verdant paradise right now, but if this doesn't happen now, it's going to become ugly. It's going to become uncontrollable, and I think they all kind of grasped what was going to happen. And I think if people don't want to accept that, and it's a big part of urban planning is predicting the future, and it's also getting people to believe what you're saying.
What other projects from this book, Chris or Sam, would have made a big difference in the shape of the city?
I think that I do think that LAX plan would have made a big difference.
The original one with the big dome,
yeah. And the reason I think it would have made a big difference. Obviously, you would have had a different experience going to LAX. It would have been much grander, less. I don't know. I don't know anybody that really looks forward to going to LAX right now. but also just the level of ambition of that architecture. I think it sort of becomes a symbol for the city and raises the bar for anything that comes after it. I think when you look at certain airports, certain pieces of architecture that are sort of in the public eye forever and ever, it becomes a standard bearer, a benchmark, and everything sort of has to, not everything, but it sort of becomes something that people always have in the back of their minds. And sort of, instead of LA becoming a place that I think a lot of times in the civic realm will settle for second best, there becomes a place where perhaps they start to expect a higher level of architecture.
But would that have worked? Would that have solved the problems of going to LAX today? I mean, you look at that space, this huge open space that would have had to been filled.
Oh, they would have had to expand it. But any airport in America has had to expand since then.
What is the lifespan of an airport?
Yeah.
It must be very short.
Yeah, I mean, any, and that's hard too. You have to be able to predict that sort of thing. But no, this wouldn't have been the only thing, but I think just the level of ambition and the architecture, and compared to what they got, is head and shoulders above.
I would mention a couple of the multifamily residential projects that are really striking in the show, particularly the Tony Lumsden project, which would have built a kind of hilltop village with a remarkable kind of density, but also thoughtfulness. Responding to the landscape in the same way that the Doheny Ranch mm-hmm. project before it did, and to in the same way that the airport project could have set a kind of benchmark for civic architecture, mm-hmm. setting those benchmarks for really elegant multifamily housing that made sense for LA, yes, that didn't try to ape Chicago or mm-hmm. New York, that made sense for this landscape and this climate, and set a kind of counterexample to the growth of the single family neighborhoods that followed. So I'd say, and there are quite a few. There are probably a good half dozen really strong projects that fall into mm-hmm. that category.
Can you describe that a little bit, how it sure. related to the mountaintop?
Sure.
It's called the Sunset...
Sunset Mountain Park. Mountain.
And it was late 60s.
In Pacific Palisades,
mid 60s.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in San Ynez Canyon.
So these guys can give more of the details, but it was a hilltop project that would have included some funiculars, right, to get people from the bottom of the hill up to the top, a number of plazas, kind of an Italian hilltop, Italian hilltown mixed with a kind of 60s futurism in a really remarkable way. And in fact, a number of the Tony Lumsden projects in the show are among my favorites, that one in the Beverly Hills Hotel. He's an architect who came out west to join Dim Jim, as Sam mentioned, and work with Cesar Pelli. And in a pretty short period produced a number of really remarkable visionary schemes, a handful of which were built, but many more which were not. And those projects really stand out for me in the show, I would say. They're always beautifully rendered as well.
And much like that, and comparable, was John Lautner's Marina View project, which was down in San Juan Capistrano, mm-hmm. Also on a hilltop. A collection, it didn't kind of cling to the hillside as much, from what I understand. It had some towers that stood out, but then others that were blended into it. But about the same time, well, even a little bit earlier, I think. Mm-hmm. So there was this idea of using everything, using land, the mountaintops from Malibu all the way down mm-hmm. to San Juan Capistrano for this sort of density.
And Lautner's, while very dense, had preserved open space. I'm going to get the ratio wrong, mm-hmm. but a very high degree of open space would have been preserved, and that's one of the reasons why it was killed off.
Yeah,
it was considered a communist socialist intervention, as was the Neutra project on Dodger Stadium, Chavez-Ravine property, which also included parks and density. At those levels. I don't think it's as elegant and doesn't hug the hill quite as much, but mm-hmm. It's still the notion of getting the density up on the hill. And
in terms of transportation, I'll mention one of the smaller projects, which I think might have had a kind of outsized impact if it had been built at scale, and that's the cycleway that was built at mm-hmm. a small bit of it, maybe a mile and a quarter, I think, was built in Pasadena, a kind of elevated cycleway that was part of what the designers imagined might be a whole citywide network, region-wide network, really, of elevated cycleways. And I think a lot of people who see the show will look at that and think, maybe we could start talking about something along those lines. So it's one of the smallest projects in terms of scale, in a way, in terms of what actually was achieved, but I think that will have some echoes, some reverberations for people now.
One of my favorites is Lloyd Wright's Civic Center up mm-hmm. up the hill here. It is extraordinary, especially given the context of this building, or the original Bertram Goodhue building, library building, which is a modern building, even though it has Egyptian elements to it. It's a modern building, and it's concrete. And if you had built something kind of complementary going up the hill, and that would have been a very a prominent building, but I think it would have been detailed in the Wrightian way with a lot of interesting textures and things for the human scale as well. But imagine, when was that, 1923, 24?
I think it's really 1925. We've seen different dates on the drawings.
I think it is 25.
But, yeah.
But a monument of California modernism of that size and scale and grandeur before Neutra really gets off the ground here to introduce European ideas, it really could have been a beacon for American modern, a whole new direction for American modernism.
And commissioned by the Los Angeles Times. So there you go. Yeah.
There you are.
Plus, the obviously, the location smack in the middle of downtown doesn't hurt. I mean, that would have... you talk about LAX being a place that everybody would have seen. It would have changed the way... If you have... That basically would have transformed the direction of downtown in a, I don't think, in a way that no city in America would have been transformed. So
plus it has that enormous, what would you call it, right up the middle, you know, kind of public walkways, mm-hmm. and then it's layered down for automobile traffic, and below that are subways. And so it's all thought out as a unified idea for public space surrounded by these monumental buildings.
And one thing to say about that plan, if you look in the book, is just the level of detail that Lloyd Wright brings. And Frank Lloyd Wright, certainly famous for his level of draftsmanship, but I think his son Lloyd, when I look at those drawings, I think he may have even surpassed him. And when you look at the originals that we got to see, but also...
come to the show and look at the originals. They're spectacular.
Yeah, but it's just... it just blows your mind. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I think the cross-hatching, I mean, he must, I don't know. I can't speak about it, but it's just... It's
he amazing. Knew how to sharpen his pencil.
You're speechless.
I am speechless. Oh, good. No, it's just, and every little, like he had, you see this grand plan that kind of stretches around, and then each little tower, he must have done like 50 little studies for, because we have those too, and he's just, you know, I don't know, his hand must have been about to fall off, but it's it's amazing.
Yeah.
So, although I would like to put a pitch in for the Pacifico Mercado, because it was a grand exposition site right next to the LA River, it would have definitely changed the face of the river right next to Elysian Park and Dodger Stadium with lakes, and it was a park basically with exposition grounds. There's the Wilshire Corridor in that the grand plan for Wilshire Corridor, and I know you've written a bit about it and researched it. Just it was impressive in that it wasn't just, you know, basically a conventional corridor plan. It included a lot of plazas and parks and attractions or sort of new development. And as you pointed out earlier, it wasn't even within the city of Los Angeles at the time. So just this forward planning about and commissioned by...
Henry O'Melveny and the Chandlers.
Trying to figure out how to make their city grow up and look a little bit no more like Paris, right?
It was very much... I love the names of all the fountains and the arches. It's like every however many feet, another fountain, another arch, fountain of youth, fountain of goodwill,
fountain of the arts. It went on and on and on all the way out to the beach.
But stunning. I mean, absolutely stunning. And Wilshire, there was an argument then about whether Wilshire was going to be a commercial corridor or whether it was going to be sort of this grand processional boulevard, like you said, like Paris or like in Europe. And we know which one won there. But it's, I mean, you think about just how much that would have changed the city. And you just take for granted that that's what Wilshire is, but it could have been very different.
Well, what did happen, of course, was A.W. Ross developed the Miracle Mile as a commercial center with Desmond's and the Wiltern and eventually the May Company as these commercial buildings stretching out, at least on that part of Wilshire. How would the city have been different, though? I mean, that's been fairly successful and a fairly strong identity. It is one of the densest urban areas in any American city as well, with the apartment houses and so forth immediately adjacent to it. Rainer Banham talked about how people could live in the Wilshire district and walk to their work in one of those high-rise towers. But how would the city have been different then if that the grand archways had been built?
I think that's a tough question. I'm sure Chris has some thoughts about this. I think about the Reforma in Mexico City as being something of an example of a street that's intended as a long, you know, sequence of monuments, and I'm not sure how well that works in terms of, you know, the city grew around it, and it's just as congested and as big a mess as anywhere you could possibly go. So I don't know.
Right. I don't know that it would have. It's an amazing plan. It would call for a series of archways and fountains, as Sam said, stretching all the way along Wilshire Boulevard to the ocean. I don't know that it would have changed the whole face of the city in the same way that, say, a subway plan, if executed in the 20s, might have. But it certainly, as opposed to the Miracle Mile, it would have put a stamp, a kind of... uniform aesthetic along an entire boulevard instead of what you get now or what we've gotten along Wilshire is a shorter, little more piecemeal parts of the boulevard that have been branded or remade in one way or another, Miracle Mile being the best known example. So it would have given, I think, the city a sense of what an entire boulevard treated that way with a single design sensibility might have looked like, and that may have prompted a similar look at the other long boulevards of the city and could have changed the way that we thought about transportation. But I think the pressure, I mean, this is true with what we were talking about with the Olmsted Plan, the pressures of the commercial pressures were already so strong with, in particular, with some of the merchants you mentioned wanting to get out of a very congested downtown and seeing the possibility for Wilshire to be a kind of linear commercial district. And that debate continues. Even this week, Frank Gehry was quoted in an interview in Los Angeles Magazine saying he thinks that Disney Hall is in the wrong place and that it should have been on Wilshire or in Westwood, and that he still thinks of Wilshire as really the center, the kind of the spine of LA, and it's downtown more than this one. He is he's a lifelong, a confirmed West Sider very much, and he's unreconstructed. But it's interesting that debate is ongoing and that he's still thinking about how the city might have changed if Disney Hall had, his one great civic triumph in LA had been placed somewhere else.
Well, I do think that because some of the solutions are multimodal and, we do have a growing population of people who cycle or who actually walk and, take public transportation with a wider roadbed, and potentially, other sort of calibrated along the way in a different way, it would have created districts or sort of smaller scale areas within the city, but also would have allowed us to rework that roadbed in a different way. So you would have had a much wider, you might have had trees down the center and trees on both sides, and, it'd just been more real estate in the public realm.
I think that's a good point. One thing that reminds me it might have done, I think that's really true, is kind of inoculated the boulevards against what happened to them in the post-war period when we became so enamored of freeways that we tried to turn even our grandest boulevards into miniature freeways. We widened them. We made more and more space for cars at the expense of everybody else. And it's hard to imagine that kind of widening happening on a Wilshire Boulevard with that kind of archway plan in place or on the other boulevards if they had been treated in the pre-war era in a different, more holistic way.
I think even if you were able to change this area around like you did in Mexico City, just the idea of what Chris was saying, that uniformity going across the whole city, that could have set a standard. There's nothing that's uniform across the city,
Right.
So just that idea, we could do this somewhere else. Just, like, the idea of it may have been more powerful than actually what it would have, it may not have held up as a boulevard, but the idea of keeping a uniformity on anything across the city may have been an idea that could have planted a seed, and that would have changed the city. So these, you don't know exactly how these things can change the city.
Would that have, talking about La Reforma or others, it's a 19th century and a Beaux-Arts concept. Wasn't Los Angeles trying to create a new type of city, again, this multi-centered one, Beverly Hills, Pasadena, downtown, and so forth, with smaller nodes intermixed so that people could be closer to, their at least shopping, et cetera. And it creates a great deal of diversity and some people say chaos, at least a lack of order, a lack of traditional order. But hasn't that, I'm not sure I completely see the advantage of having unity over diversity.
I don't think the city's ever made up its mind about that, truthfully. If you go back to the Charles Mulford Robinson proposal, which is essentially to turn L.A. into some kind of houseman's Paris, with grand boulevards with, 7 or 8-story buildings, perhaps a little taller, lining them and going off in every direction, and downtown as the center. That was the City Beautiful idea for Los Angeles, and I think to some degree it held sway for at least through the
they tried like
World
hell
War
to keep that.
II.
They failed, but they tried.
But at the same time, the city just wouldn't behave and wouldn't cooperate with that notion, and so you got, as you say, Alan, this multinodal, or it's all scattered, and then In the post-war era, Calvin Hamilton, I think, is the one who really diagnosed it first or understood it the best and proposed that we should, okay, let's just link up all these different places and scale them according to kind of their relevance and prominence where they stand. But I don't think we've ever resolved it. I think downtown L.A. still wishes, despite what Frank Gehry would say, still wishes that it were the center of this great metropolis.
Right.
And then Torrance thinks it's the center of its own metropolis, and neither one is ever going to shake hands
Torrance.
And agree.
Yeah,
shout out.
And they're both very powerful and persuasive arguments, I think.
Well, that's I think to give credit to the these guys in the show. One of the nice sort of sub themes of the show are these running arguments, and they kind of bubble, you know, they kind of run below the surface of the show. And one very much of the most striking is, what does downtown mean? Going back to the Lloyd Wright plan, should we try to make downtown the center or the first among equals in a polycentric region, or is it just one of many? And that is an ongoing debate. I think that is a debate that we're continuing to have now, but it pops up in almost every era in the show. You can find a project from the 20s, again from the 50s, 70s, and from more recently that is acting out one part of that, one side of that argument.
That's what's fun about this stretching for so long. All these things keep coming up. Every issue that you see comes up every 10 years, every five, you know, throughout history of LA, it doesn't change. And Alan, you bring up a good point, which is, you know, you were asking, like, maybe that wouldn't have been a good thing. And one thing that Greg and I was important in our research was that we're not making a judgment of necessarily whether we think it would have been a good thing or a bad thing, just more importantly, whether it would have changed the city. We have our own opinions sometimes.
We sure do.
Well, maybe the creative tension of these unresolved issues is what keeps the city growing and moving. We've touched a bit upon some questions relating to who makes these decisions. Who decides that this gets built and that doesn't? And you've mentioned a couple. Could we talk a bit about that? What are the forces behind the scenes that said that these should or should not be built?
It's not us, I can tell you that. And I think, I mean, Mia, you're in a very good position to talk about this.
The LA Times made some important decisions. Who makes these decisions? About some of these projects, where I think there's certain agencies that are probably well positioned to make these decisions, especially if they are well funded to do projects. So, but a lot of these projects came out as a result of efforts from the civically minded people, which was really interesting. The LA Times was prominent leaders within the Times, Chamber of Commerce, as the Olmsted Plan. And they knew how to reach out and try to get the right people at the table. And I would say, in the end, it probably points to our mayoral system, and we were talking about it briefly, because implementing projects like this required funding and required, you know, basically voting at a certain level, whether it was at the city or the county. Several projects required both, and sometimes at the state level. And they just went down in flames when all these people couldn't come together, and especially where there wasn't any funding for them. So that's what I would say. So, but in general, I think it's also about values, and the values that we hope that the citizenry and the leadership hold. That, you know, people just didn't feel, you know, either, you know, empowered enough or didn't want to go the distance to make the projects happen. But I'm sure you guys have given this a lot of thought, too.
Well, you mentioned that one of the monorail projects was voted down, right? So it was a grassroots decision.
Right. Well, okay, the earliest transit proposal, 1925, the Kelkern Deleuze, which would have built...
Well, the earliest that we have.
Well, yeah, I'm talking about one that came to a vote that I'm aware of. which would have been subways and also elevateds and other form of public transit. That was defeated in a straw poll in the city.
As was the Archway Plan, I believe.
Right.
I'm pretty sure the Archway Plan came up for a vote and was defeated as well.
Absolutely correct. So those are examples of where the voters didn't have the insight or the foresight to embrace what might have been really game-changing plans. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we do have a very weak mayoral system. It's written into the charter in Los Angeles. You've got the 15 city councilmen who kind of have their own little bailiwicks and can do basically what they want. And the mayor has no power to initiate anything where he can actually have a budget behind it. That's not like, you know, not like New York. We talked a lot about this before. You know, Bloomberg can sort of do what he wants. He controls the Board of Education. He controls the Planning Commission there. He, you know, he can appoint a design czar who might actually be able to wield power and money. What do you do in Los Angeles if you're the mayor? You can only sort of stand up at the dais and say, I want this.
And you don't have a mayor that's very powerful, and you don't have a planning department that can be as proactive as you might want them to be. That's set up by the
charter.
They
can't initiate anything. They don't have the actual authority to initiate a plan. Plans must come to them for approval, not the other way around.
And you have just the geography of Los Angeles. You have a population that's spread out all over the place and in the hills, and who cares if you're up here, what's going on down there, or if you're on the west side, what's going on the east side. It's just, it can be hard to coalesce behind a plan. And it's one thing if you're building a house, you know, you don't need critical will to be behind you. But if you're building a major civic project, you need to have a lot of support. And that it's hard to get people behind to coalesce around anything here. So.
And I think it's important to say that at least to a certain extent and in certain periods in LA's history, some of that fragmentation was willful. There was a sense that many of the people who were coming here were doing so in part to get away from cities where they felt the weight of history and collective opinion. Mm-hmm. And the idea of consensus and a city being unified in that way. And what was attractive about Los Angeles to them was that it wasn't that kind of city. As you suggested, there was an effort to create a new kind of city that really fostered a kind of individual, pursued individual ambition, and that has led to a city that hasn't been, as we've all said in various ways, been very effective at advancing a kind of collective idea. Some of that is structural. Some of that is now we're fighting against and thinking about how we can undo it. But I think you could at least make the argument that some of that was willful. There was a kind of separation of powers. People didn't necessarily want to live in a city that felt like New York or Chicago. And it's a complicated question, but I think that the way in which the city was attractive to people because of that freedom and what you said about the backyard that you could have instead of one Central Park, we built, you know, tens of thousands of miniature Central Parks, and that was attractive to people. The question now is, because that city is not available to people anymore,
yeah, exactly.
Because you can't move here as a middle-class family and afford that little slice, that little backyard piece of paradise, what do we do now once we've put all of those structures in place that make it terribly difficult to advance a kind of more ambitious collective idea?
And you know, what Christopher is saying is it's really true, and the sort of inside run on that is that we got some of the best residential architecture in the world because of that,
right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That ethos. Mm-hmm. But it couldn't be made into public architecture.
And the division, we talked about the division between whether we're going to be a horizontal city or a vertical city. Mm-hmm. I think that division between public and private is, that's just as equal. That's the big division in the city.
Well, there's no question that the sort of private interests and the private economic interests basically prevailed, and that the public realm and the collective did not sort of in any way win.
Right.
And the question really is, I mean, that happened. It's true, and can you reel that back?
Well, it's making a comeback, I think.
Okay.
What's making it come
back? Sam's an optimist.
I'm an optimist.
I think the idea of the public
is. I mean, if you look around at the parks that have been developed just in this past couple of years, downtown, the Civic Park, and you look at the transit system that's now sort of a little bit late but starting to really come into its own, and of course it'll take another 20 years, but there are movements, I think, that really the will of the public is actually starting to. LA is actually starting to transform that way. It's just it's going to take a long time, and it's not easy.
Are there forces there that can be harnessed to speed that up, or to really make those forces
create a better public realm?
Well, we've talked about, you know, like Mia was saying, a design czar, you know. I think the will is here in L.A. I think we've always seen the will is here, especially now. I think it's more than ever, but changing the infrastructure of the city is a lot harder, and changing the culture of the way the government here works and the way the system works, so that's the hard part.
I think that when we talk about a design czar and an urban design, you know, czar, we talk about the public realm, but also, good design. And, really pushing forward important projects within the public realm that have a certain quality to them. And that's a hard one to, you know, it's elusive when people ask you, well, what do you mean by good design? Well, you know, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. But I do think that there's examples. For example, the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy. It's an entity that is very nimble and that operates for the public good and has purchased 150,000 acres on behalf of the citizens of, you know, the county. So they have wrung the city and sort of limited growth in those mountains around us, just like the Olmsted plan originally wanted to do. But then we opened up those hillsides with R1, your favorite, mm-hmm. right? this other thing ensued. But, you know, there is a movement afloat in the way also rivers and streams are sort of having a comeback as places of desire and big ideas. And I think we're also more connected these days. I mean, you know, I was going to say, you know, obviously social media alone gives you that much more power, right?
And I think it's important also to look back at the moments when the region has come together in a kind of consensus. And they haven't come as often as we all would have liked, but there are these moments of real consensus and real infrastructural ambition. So going back all the way to the aqueduct and the water, you know, water policy, freeway construction, whatever we make of the freeways now, that effort to build that freeway system was an incredible public works, civic works project of really far-reaching ambition. And then the battle about air quality and smog in the post-war era, another moment when people came together. I think you could say that for school construction, whether or not we love the architecture that was produced, that effort to make up for lost time and build all those schools. And then the transit, you know, Measure R, the 2008 vote was really another watershed moment. I think we'll see more of those around transit. So there are these few moments. It takes crisis. It takes,
and
you know.
LA River.
And there's one underway right now, right, which is the right. LA River,
exactly.
The 6th Street Bridge, which would have, whether we think that design is the best design we could have gotten, at least because FOLAR, the Friends of the LA River, pushed for some kind of a design competition, we got a better bridge than I think we would have had if it had just been left to the internal mechanism of the Bureau of Engineering. So, and that's a really recent example of where design became the paramount concern.
By the way, we do have a design czar. We have somebody who's in charge of LA's public architecture, you know, limited capacities, Deborah Weintraub. And I think she does a wonderful job, but she's limited in her scope. And she actually is head of architecture, but she works under the Bureau of Engineering, which I always think is hilarious.
Well, but the Bureau of Engineering also endowed us with the single greatest sequence of bridges in the United States, the crossing the LA River. There's not a better example of public architecture, I think, that I can think of in any major city than those bridges that Merrill Butler designed
and every time
and built.
I go through, you know, an interchange, whether it's the four level or the 10 and the 405, I'm always just, you know, thrilled by, you know, the kinetic angles and curves of that experience open to everybody. Well, Sam, you had talked about a level of...
At what time of day, Alan?
You talked about a level of quality. You'd said that that original LAX plan would have been a benchmark of a design, what, vision, imagination, et cetera. A design, an architectural czar isn't going to be able to enforce that sort of level of quality. It does have to have widespread support in the public. What can be done to raise that level of consciousness of what good design means in a city?
Well, in a small way, very small way, that's what we're trying to do, to some respect, to make people, to try to change in a small way the culture of LA to not accept, to make sure that visionary projects that are going to change the city actually happen and don't keep getting caught up in these morasses that they have over the more than 100 years. But also, I think that, you know, you need to coalesce behind basically, you know, the energy that we have in this city, which is amazing. I think it's one of the most creative cities, if not the most creative city in the country, or one of the most creative cities in the world. And yet we still generally settle for second-rate civic infrastructure and architecture in a lot of respects. So you have to. There's a way to harness that. If I knew exactly how to harness that, I think I'd be pretty amazing. But I don't.
You'd be the czar.
I'd be the czar. I would be the czar, and I like the idea of being a czar, but I don't. But I think that's the challenge. I think, you know, I think Christopher plays a role in that. I think all journalists play a role in that. I think everybody here plays a role in that. I think certainly the mayor plays a role, and even though they're not, the mayor is not particularly strong, they still have a huge bully pulpit to sort of change that culture, I think we are looking to Garcetti because he's professed an interest in design. It's very early now, but we have to see if he's gonna follow through on that. Because Bloomberg certainly in New York has done that, you know, incredibly well. He's behind design, and it shows. And the city of New York over his tenure has just transformed incredibly when it comes to urban design and architecture. And I think, you know, obviously architects have a role in that. There's a lot of architects now that are not working in Los Angeles, that are from Los Angeles, and they can try to, you know, work on finding ways to work here. But I think there has to be work available to them, and there has to be opportunities. And so if anybody wants to run to be czar and figure that out, that'd be great. Yeah.
Well, there's no question that in the exhibit there's so much talent. I mean, there is some great, great architecture. The Griffith Park Nature Center by John Lautner is just a phenomenal design by one of Los Angeles's great architects. But I particularly love the movie theaters by S. Charles Lee, because there were like a dozen or so of them that you had in the book of these incredible, from the 1930s and 1940s, incredible local monuments, basically, with incredible signs for the public space of a movie theater, where people, you know, used to go out before Netflix. But there is so much talent in Los Angeles, inspired by Los Angeles, I think, as well, that this book does show. Well, any more comments? I think we'll turn to the audience and get a couple questions, and we can continue. Are we ready for the microphones?
I'm interested in each of you just saying whether or not there's any particular design that you think it's a good fact. You think it's good for the city that it wasn't built.
Well, the 4-mile grid of freeways, the original freeway proposal was that you would never be 4 miles away from a freeway entrance. And when you look at the maps, it's every single canyon. You can't name a canyon between, you know, the basin and the San Fernando Valley, either and going into the San Gabriel Valley and then the other way out, you know, toward Calabasas. Every single canyon would have been turned into a freeway, a 4-lane freeway. So that's one that immediately comes to mind. But it wasn't so much killed off as it was just too expensive to build. Couldn't do it.
Aside from the causeway, which is the obvious answer to that question, I would say I would also nominate the skyscraper that Donald Trump was planning on the site of the Ambassador Hotel, which would have been, I think, the world's tallest building, at least the tallest building in America.
What do you have against that one?
Gold-plated, too.
Yeah,
gold-plated.
It's absolutely worth seeing and marveling at, and thanking our lucky stars that it's in there.
And on a local level, Prayer and Luckman, who brought us the LAX plan that I like so much, they had a plan. The initial plan for the redevelopment of Bunker Hill, where we are now, was going to put all the development on super blocks, so basically raised plinths above any sort of street life, which sort of like the Music Center, which I think actually, personally, I think that works well in an isolated location, but to have all of downtown, essentially, or most of it, on those kinds of super blocks, sort of raised from the riffraff of the street, as it were, I think would have just completely destroyed any sort of urban street life in Los Angeles. So I'm happy that that one did. Plus, it would have been interspersed with freeways going through these super blocks. So
yeah.
I think that was a big escape.
Hi. So you were talking about LAX and that original plan. I was curious if any of you guys have been to see a preview of the international terminal that's opening next month or the month after or something like that, and what you think of it.
I've seen it. Have you guys? I think several of us have been through it.
I haven't been through yet.
Okay. You take that one.
Oh, Sam, boy.
I'm happy to offer some comments, but...
I was actually pleasantly surprised by that building. It's certainly not at the level of this, but it's ambitious, and it sort of captures the spirit of, you know, the jet age of sort of the soaring architecture that was once a staple of architecture of airports, which has been replaced by sort of generic, sort of you feel like you're in a mall instead of an airport, and you still sort of feel like you're in a mall in the new LAX, but I do
it's
like...
It's a nice mall. Though.
It's a very nice mall.
Nice mall.
Yeah. with some... I mean, just the scale of these vaults and arches, and you it does have that kind of uplift when you walk in, sort of takes your breath away before you get to the Fendi store, which I think is...
It's another kind of uplift.
Yeah, so I think it's admirable. I do have complaints about it, but I think I was pleasantly surprised by that.
I should say it's designed by Kurt Fentress. And I actually was impressed in many respects, but I think the issue is that it's just one part of a larger airport complex mm-hmm. that needs lots of improvements, starting with getting public transportation right into the airport.
That'd be nice.
But as a building, it's impressive.
When we heard about and we saw the picture of the Olmsted plan and what had not been built, there seemed to have been a collective sigh as though we had lost our favorite maiden aunt sometime. But don't you think we need to look at that, what we lost, in a historical perspective? Because at the time, there was nothing but open space in Los Angeles. There were truck farms within blocks of where we are right now. And if urban planning, the genius of it, is to predict, how can you predict something that's going to happen 70 years hence? So, and then when you talk about what we lost or potentially lost when we had setback rules for where structures could be built, which allowed for spaces for lawns and green spaces and trees, and it wasn't until the public decided to trump that, how do we assess what we lost when it just wasn't, that value wasn't there at that time?
Well, you know, it's a little different to have unbuilt areas that, you know, are not necessarily managed for sort of for a public experience, whether it's parks or trails or connections between communities that, you know, so it's really about, you know, that public realm. So just because there's a unbuilt area that you can go and explore doesn't mean that you're in a tamed area that really creates the, you know, that actually frames a city or frames a neighborhood and connects you. Right now, we're only connected by freeways, and pretty far away, we're connected by the mountains. This would have been a way for this very large expanse, you know, which the megalopolis that we are, which is really Los Angeles and 88 other cities, to be more connected. And there was some thought. It was associated with the higher elevations of some of the mountains, and then alongside some of the streams. It actually did not include the LA River, I hate to say.
They wanted to build a freeway down the LA River
in that proposal. I know.
Talk about thinking ahead.
So anyway, I just think that's, so creating a framework. I mean, there are many people, and some of them in this audience, that are building cities or mega cities in other parts of the world. And you have to think ahead of you know, what might happen. You know, you having a framework of parks and open space and then public transportation becomes sort of the essential elements of a city.
Each of you name one or two projects that are either on the drawing board now or concepts or ideas that you think will come up in the next 5 or 10 years that we should get behind so that we don't read about it in your second edition.
Who asked that question? Oh.
Wow, that's a hard one.
Definitely her LA River plan.
Yeah, the LA River plan.
It's not just my plan, but
no,
it's not just
She's
my plan.
Credit.
I'm representing a team of people that's been working on this plan, several landscape architects and professionals and engineers, but also two now, the Friends of the LA River, who actually sort of got us all inspired 30 years ago, but then now the River Corporation and the River Office within the city and the Planning Department. So please stay tuned. There's a lot going on, and we need the love. We need the community to really get behind. The Corps of Engineers at a federal level has declared it a navigable waterway. Please go down the river on a raft. There are several options now. And there's a lot of great opportunities for parks and also redevelopment opportunities if anybody's interested, turning industry into something else.
And then sort of an analogous proposal to that is the freeway caps, cap both the 101 freeway, which, you know, ripped open the fabric of the northern part of downtown, and then the freeway cap park that would span the 110 freeway to reconnect it to kind of the Temple Bowdry or that area back to downtown. Those are really important proposals.
And it's funny that some of the bigger proposals now are undoing the mistakes, or I guess I'd consider the mistakes of earlier planning. And that's the big challenge now, is sort of putting the pieces back together that were sort of ripped apart, as you put it.
I would add to that a couple of things. That it's a really good question. The subway on Wilshire that Beverly Hills and others other parts of the city are still trying to fight. So that's still up in the air, though it looks pretty promising that will be built. And then the second thing I would say is just some conversation and some new models, which I think we're all looking for, connecting back to my earlier comment about some kind of moderate increase in density in single-family neighborhoods, looking at accessory dwelling units that should be mandated by state law but are very hard to execute in cities like Los Angeles, beginning to have a conversation about a kind of moderate residential density that makes sense for the city, that's not high-rise towers, but is moving a little bit away from the kind of single-family paradigm, which still controls so much of the city.
And what about Prop 13?
Yeah.
Right. Well, then there's policy questions. Yeah, talking about Prop 13, talking about CEQA reform. I mean, there's some other conversations that are beginning that are not about buildings or proposals, but they're about
and redevelopment policy. Agencies as well, recreating whatever power that they had, which were a great influence.
Very true.
I'd have to add one more policy factor, which is historic preservation, which Los Angeles was not known for, but the Los Angeles Conservancy has become one of the most far-sighted preservation groups in the country. And there's still a tremendous amount of architecture out there that does need to be protected, but also in the larger scope, fitted into the larger planning issues of Los Angeles. Not just saving a building for the sake of saving a building, but seeing how architecture, old architecture, does add to the identity, to the creation of a neighborhood, there's still so much that is threatened out there, especially I would say in the San Fernando Valley, in the suburban areas, all over the metropolitan area. In order to be able to strengthen those areas, use what it has been, what has worked, and improve on what needs to be improved upon.
I have so many questions and so many things to talk about, but I'm really curious about how to coalesce a coalition to enact change. And I'm thinking about what I've been hearing lately about, like, for example, Hollywood Millennium Project, and how there are people on both sides of that issue, and there have smart people who are saying, oh, we shouldn't, you know, that's the wrong kind of development there, and other smart people who are saying, well, that kind of density is what the city needs, and that transit-oriented thing. And I see that playing out, that kind of confusion about issues. I mean, the LA River is an easier one. There's like pretty much a lot of people can agree on. But then there's like the Silver Lake Meadow where like, why couldn't we have a larger park? And then you have the neighbors there saying, oh, we don't want all these people coming into the area. So you see, like, even where you feel like you have like a coalition, all of a sudden it starts breaking down between public and private, even with people who say that they really are for the public space. So I'm interested in those things and how they're getting broken out into that in public, in contemporary policy right now.
I should say small groups that are away from the infrastructure of the government can have very powerful impacts, like the High Line in New York is a really good example. Not instigated by the government, but the Friends of the High Line, a nonprofit that took matters in their own hand, then got the support of the city, and I think made one of the most amazing public spaces that we've had in the last few decades. So that's an example. I don't know if there's...
I think the Millennium Hollywood is a great emblem of some of the confusion, as you put it, and the dialogue and how the discussion of these issues has been stunted, and this is one of the arguments I think that the show makes as well. I have been disappointed both in the quality of the architecture of those towers, but also the level of conversation about it, and this probably falls on all of us as writers as well, because we have a responsibility to try to elevate that debate. But just those towers are a perfect example. There has been opposition to those towers, and in a concession, the developer agreed to bring down the height. But what hasn't been talked about enough, in my opinion, is that the buildings have as many square feet as they had before. So instead of being tall and rather slender, they will be shorter and much squatter. And that has been counted as a victory for the opponents of density, when in fact I think that the new version of the towers will not only be not as impressive in the skyline architecturally, it'll have more of a visual impact on Capitol Records, which was supposed to be the whole goal of the opponents of that project. So I don't think that the way that that design has changed and the way the debate has played out has said particularly good things about how we talk about, you know, we don't have a history of talking about skyscrapers, how they work in the skyline, how their design ought to be changed. And that's, you know, one of the lessons of the show. So I hope that, you know, moving forward, we'll start to have a sort of more nuanced debate about how these buildings operate.
And what's really interesting is that nobody has talked about the impact that that development has on that community. And there isn't any community benefit package, there is no city in the country that doesn't insist on some kind of community benefit package, which means think about not only where people are parking within the complex, but how it's impacting everywhere around you. And given the potential sort of value of that development, to create a, you know, what about a contribution to the Park 101? Or what is it that is this project is bringing to the community at large? So it's not dealing with sidewalks and the way it extends out into Hollywood in a meaningful way. And I think that conversation doesn't happen at all.
I actually think that's this only strong part of the project, frankly, is where it meets the ground. I think it's pretty good at the ground level. I think it's much worse in the sky. I think the really the strongest element is the treatment of the open space.
There you go. I'm talking more than a block away.
Sure.
Not talking like the immediate blocks. I'm talking like five blocks away, because it's going to impact everybody else around you.
What you're talking about, Mia, the problem is that the neighborhood associations themselves, who have a tremendous impact on the final result of a project, generally are not very far-sighted themselves.
Yes.
And so they'll look for ways to, you know, understandably, they don't want their neighborhood to be turned into yet another place that, you know,
the Oshawa Furrier being proposed or Bunker Hill being completely erased. And then now, after that, it's sort of swung the other direction. And any sort of development, there's a knee-jerk reaction to. It doesn't matter what it is. It's like, we don't want it. I don't care what it is. And now we have a time, I think, of general timidity and a general sort of fear and sort of mistrust. And so how do you get it to the point where you can have development, just make sure it's done in a sensitive, intelligent way, but not kind of just snuff out all development altogether.
Because the flip side of that structure, the political structure that we talked about being fragmented and making it very hard to advance a consensus, it's a structure that makes it very easy to oppose things, actually. It's very successful for opposing and stopping projects, and sometimes that's a very positive thing, and sometimes it's not. And there have been more and more sort of structure and policy changes that have added to the power of those who are hoping to say no, and I think that's one of the real strong lessons of the show is seeing that kind of opposite push for more progressive ideas about what can be created that can be helpful to the city.
Well, and I would urge everybody to go to the show. It has good examples, it has bad examples, and you have to figure out which is what is the good educational aspect of it. So I think we're going to have to wrap up now, but thank you to the panel, and thank you to Aloud, and thank you to the audience.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.